Hi friends, this is Henrik Palmgren and you are listening to Red Ice Creations Radio. Nice to have you with us. Thank you for tuning in to the program. We are here every Sunday and Thursday recording a new program from the west coast of Sweden. Take a look at our website, redicecreations.com. News updates, radio archives, forum subscriber section, and a lot of resources and links to interesting and important research, videos, reports, and news. And I hope you all had a good week so far. I'm glad that you are here today, because we have a very interesting guest with us and a very interesting subject lined up today. Geologist, author, and researcher Scott Walter is with us, and we are going to talk about the Kensington Runestone. This is a fascinating story about one of Minnesota's greatest mysteries, and if the data that Scott has uncovered is accurate, we for sure have to rewrite the history of how the Americas was discovered, because this puts settlers in America well before Columbus. This is a fascinating story, and it's great to have Scott with us today, who has been researching this for a long time with us to talk about this. The website that you should take a look at right away is KensingtonRunestone.com. And Scott, together with Richard Nielsen, wrote a book called The Kensington Runestone, Compelling New Evidence. And this is available on their website. I also know that Scott is in the process of writing another book on this subject, and we'll talk more about that later on in the show. But right now, let's bring on our guest and say hello. Welcome to the program, Scott. Thank you for coming on Red Ice Creations Radio.
Well, thank you for having me, Henrik, and it's great to be here. I'm looking forward to visiting with you.
Definitely. It's a pleasure to have you here, Scott. Thank you again for taking the time to speaking with us. And as I said, this is a fascinating story, and there's a lot of lots to talk about when it comes to the Kensington Runestone. But kind of to get things going here, I know that you have a background in forensic geology, and I'd love to hear a little bit about how you kind of ended up being involved with the research on the Kensington Runestone.
Okay. Well, yes, I'm a geologist by education, and fortunately by profession. I really feel fortunate that I'm able to work in the field that I really, really love. And basically what I do is I run a laboratory and we do material forensics, and primarily on concrete and rock. And essentially what we do are autopsies on concrete and rock. And most of the things that we work on are problems or issues. Something is not going well, and they will hire us as an independent laboratory to try to generate a database that hopefully will help us understand what may or may not have caused a particular problem. So that's what we do pretty much day in and day out. Now, occasionally we'll get some unusual projects that come in. We've worked on some amazing things. We've actually worked on the Pentagon after 9/11, and looked at the structural members of the concrete there for fire damage. Hmm. We worked on an interesting murder case where a victim was encased in concrete. We did some age dating work there. So those are a couple of the unusual projects, but I think probably the most unusual problem we had come in was the Kensington Runestone. Mm-hmm. And that was in July of 2000. And I remember when I received the phone call and the representative of the museum started to talk to me about the runestone like I knew what it was. And I stopped them and I said, "What is that? I've never heard of this thing before." So I literally came into this blind.
Hmm. Is that it? Okay, interesting. You know, and there's a lot of avenues to go here right away. Of course, we want to get into of course, your findings and all of this, what kind of how the dating process works, what your conclusions are and all of this. But let's talk a little bit about how the stone was found and when it was found and by whom and so forth.
Sure. Well, I think what I'll do is, you know, I like to think about this at this point in time. I don't like to go back and talk about the past unless we need to. In other words, I don't want to. I think what I want to do is talk about what our research has uncovered, and there have been a few changes in some of the details of the discovery and things that happened shortly after that. But essentially, what happened is there was a man by the name of Olaf Ullmann, who was originally from, he was an immigrant from Forsadalen Parish in Helsingland, Sweden, which is north of Stockholm, about a 2.5 hour train ride. I've been there a couple times.
Mm.
And he came into this country in 1879 and worked as a carpenter and built many homes in the general area around Alexandria, Minnesota, which is about 15 miles east of Kensington. He went back to Sweden, I believe, in 1882. Then he came back in 1884 and got married and then bought a parcel of land over near Kensington, Minnesota, in 1890. And then that first winter, he and his wife and two small children lived in what they called the cave, which was basically a hole they dug on the hill, and they built a shelter to get through the winter. And then in 1891, he built what would be their permanent residence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 7 years later, he was clearing land on the next parcel of property. He then bought a 40-acre parcel of property that was attached to that original parcel of property. And he and his two oldest sons, Olaf Oman Jr., who was 12 years old at the time, and his second oldest son, Edward, who was 9, about ready to turn 10, were helping their father, Olaf, clear trees from the top of the, I guess it would be the easternmost knoll on that property.
Mm.
According to 12 witnesses who saw the stone, the tree, and the roots, and signed written affidavits, including Edward and Olaf, they tipped over. Olaf said he cut the roots off around the base of a 25 to 30-year-old aspen tree, or poplar tree, as they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And they used a winch, and they tipped over the tree, which pulled the stump out of the ground at the same time, to expose this 202-pound stone that was tightly wrapped in the roots of that tree.
Mm.
It was the younger son, Edward, who first noticed that there was some writing on it. And their first thought was that it might be an Indian almanac, something related to the Native Americans.
Mm, yeah.
They mentioned, and their subsequent descendants, who we have gotten to know personally, mentioned that there were many Native American artifacts that were found on the Oman farm throughout the years.
Hmm.
Very common, so I guess it would be natural for them, for that to be their first thought.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, it didn't turn out to be that way. And in the days after the stone was found, there was quite a bit of commotion. And soon after that, within a few days, we now know that the stone was found in September, which would have been right at the time when they were harvesting, and there was an awful lot of work to be done on the farms in that area in preparation for winter.
Mm-hmm.
The stone was then brought into Kensington, into town, where it was displayed in the jewelry store, Sam Sievert's jewelry store, for a couple of months. And everybody went back to work, and it was relatively quiet. Well, after the weather turned cold and the fall chores were done, and this is speculation on my part, but that this is the timing of where the stone we know was and what happened.
Hmm.
The stone then went back out to the Oman farm, and Olaf Oman, who was a very intelligent man, and we know this because the family has given us access to his entire book collection. When we were in Helsingland, Sweden, we met the descendants of his brother and sister, who had over 60 letters that Olaf Oman wrote from Kensington back to his family in Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went there in 2000, and 2003 and then 2004, we were able to see these letters. Nobody else had ever seen these letters before we did.
Hmm.
So that was quite a revelation. But anyway, Olaf sat down and he tried to figure out what was in the inscription. His neighbors, of course, everybody in the community knew all about the stone by this time,
mm-hmm.
and this would have been in December of 1898. He sat down and tried to figure it out. A couple of his neighbors gave him some books that had some runes in them. Olaf Oman did testify that he said, hey, look, every kid in Sweden knows what runes are and about Vikings and that history.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, I don't know enough how to use them.
Mm.
And so these references, one of them was a book about Swedish grammar. that had Swedish grammar in it. Another one was a very common book, basically was a Swedish almanac about history and geography that probably half the settlers at that time had.
Mm-hmm.
Now, later on, many people would accuse him of using those documents to carve the stone. But we know now that you can't even come close to carving that inscription using these documents.
Okay.
And Olaf, even though he tried to figure it out, he was unsuccessful.
Hmm.
It was at that point that he decided to seek some outside help. And what he did is he made a copy of the inscription. He wrote it down in pencil on a piece of paper. He then sent that copy along with a letter written by a neighbor of his, John Hedberg, and it was sent to Minneapolis, where it was received by a man named Swan Turnblad, who published the Svenska Amerikanska Posten newspaper, and it was sent that all the immigrants would read.
Mm-hmm.
Swan Turnblad then walked that letter and the copy of the inscription. This is very important, Henrik.
Mm-hmm.
He walked that copy over to the University of Minnesota, where he gave it to the then professor of Scandinavian languages, Olaus Breda.
Mm-hmm.
Olaus Breda then looked at the copy of the inscription that Olaf Oman made, and he thought he saw some English words. He thought he saw some modern Swedish words. He didn't even recognize the numbers, the pedantic numbers, for what they were, and he dismissed it as a hoax immediately.
Hmm. Really?
Now, that's a very important precedent, I believe, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But he never saw the stone. This becomes very important. Swan Turnblad then published Olaf's copy of the inscription in his newspaper. Copies of that newspaper then made their way back to Norway and Sweden, where three more experts looked at the copy that was printed in the newspaper, and they dismissed it as well.
Hmm.
So within 3 months of him making that copy, you've got probably the four top experts at that time who dismissed the inscription. Very important point here, after only looking at the copy.
Hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now, let me just make one more point to illustrate why that was so critical.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most powerful pieces of evidence that linguists and runologists have used against the stone is the first word on the split side, which is H-A-R, har, which, as I understand, and I don't speak Swedish or Norwegian, and I know enough about runes to be extremely dangerous, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Dick Nielsen can certainly speak with more authority. But as I understand it, the word har is a modern Swedish word.
That's right.
And it was one of the most powerful pieces of evidence used against the stone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
But here's the reality. When you look at the rune stone, there are two dots, umlauts, above the A in that word that are not in the copy.
Okay, I see.
Which changes the word from har to hair.
That's right.
There are 10 men. Is that not an old Swedish word?
Well, it's a current word. I mean, if you remove the dots, then it basically means have. If you add the dots, it basically means here.
Right. Here are 10 men by the sea with our ship, 14 days journey. But that is also an old Swedish word.
Yeah.
But the point is that these guys looked at the copy. Olaf Oman made that copy, and the dots are not above that A rune.
Mm.
Let me ask you this. If Olaf Oman was the forger, why aren't those dots there?
Hmm.
The reason those dots aren't there is because he didn't see them. Because he didn't know they were there, because he didn't carve it. But you see how this led to what happened?
Yeah, okay.
This is a very important point. I could tell you a million stories like this. This thing was never properly studied from the get-go. People made quick decisions. I could say a lot of things, but this is the fact of the matter. And imagine back in 1898, there was no electricity in that house. And in Minnesota, as it is over in Scandinavia, in December, it gets dark pretty quick, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
and the stone was, I've read many references by people at that time who said there was still dirt in the stone.
Mm.
So the fact that he missed those dots seems perfectly reasonable to me.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, do we know if the stone actually was in bad shape when they found it? Have restoration been made to it? What's going on there?
Well, let me tell you what else happened that was very, very important, in my opinion, okay?
Mm.
When the stone first came to my lab, and I looked at it, the inscription looked very fresh. And over the years that I studied the stone along with Dick, I found 12 references where people made mention of the fresh appearance of the stone.
Hmm.
Well, and when I looked at it, I thought to myself, 1362? I said, that doesn't look very old. But when I got it under the microscope, I could see at the bottom of the grooves, you could see it was scratched out. But the walls of the grooves were very weathered. I also found a number of references, including one where Olaf Ullmann himself said, I took a nail and I scratched out the inscription.
Hmm.
This is why it has the fresh appearance. And I know for a fact that this has caused confusion and bias on the part of past investigators.
Hmm.
And the reason I know this is because it happened to me.
Hmm.
And it wasn't until I got down in the microscope that I realized, okay, now I understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense to me that Olaf would do this so he could read it and see what was there and clean it out at the same time.
Sure.
But that does not sound like the actions of a forger to me.
No.
Why would he scratch out, this weathered appearance that presumably he was accused of waiting years to create by some people that want to claim it's a forgery?
Sure.
That's not proof of anything. That's more of a people thing, but it has impact. I don't know why he would do that, but he said he did it.
Yeah.
It seems like an innocent thing to me, but it also created more problems for him that he never foresaw at the time.
Mm, yeah, that's right. So, but as you say, the edges are still,
yes,
left as original, and I guess that you have been studying that and
correct,
coming up to a conclusion about
correct
the age and stuff?
Well, let me tell you what what we did. Fortunately, Olaf did not scratch out the entire inscription. There are 12 runes on the what I call the split side of the stone where the last three lines are.
Mm-hmm.
He did not carve out about a dozen characters on the left-hand side as you're looking at the inscription. You're reading it right side up.
Mm-hmm.
At the bottom of many of those grooves, I found pits that had iron oxide staining that were roughly equidimensional in shape. The stone has a lot of pyrite in it, fool's gold. And when you carve that stone, you're going to expose some of those pyrite crystals.
Mm-hmm.
Pyrite is an iron sulfide that weathers relatively fast. My conclusion was these pits at the bottom of these grooves that had not been scratched, the original, that represent the original inscription, were completely weathered away. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The question is, how long did that take? Fortunately for us, some language students in 1985, after hearing an inspired lecture by a professor at the University of Minnesota by the name of Anatoly Lieberman,
mm-hmm,
they just heard an hour lecture about the Kensington Runestone and why it was a hoax. And these five students decided to play a prank. They went up into Kensington, and they carved an inscription on a large boulder, and they dated it in pedantic numbers, 1363.
Mm-hmm.
This stone was found in 2001, and it was brought into my laboratory eventually, and I looked at it as well.
Mm.
At the bottom of the grooves on that stone, which we now know was carved in 1985, because these people came forward and admitted it, there was pyrite, the same type of pyrite, same crystal habit, and most importantly, the same grain size.
Hmm.
But these pyrites on the AVM stone, we call it now, were still actively corroding.
Hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That stone was returned to the farmer who owns that property, who lives right next to the Ullmann farm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I asked those farmers, I said, keep that thing outside and let it go, because that thing is an active experiment that's still weathering.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as it still weathers, it pushes the clock back on those pyrite pits on the runestone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It has now been, what, 22 years?
something like that.
Those pyrites are still weathering.
Yeah.
So what it means is that those pyrite pits are at least 22 years old from 1898, because that's when the stone was pulled out of the ground. It hasn't been in a weathering environment since. Olaf Ullmann immigrated here in 1879. Those pyrites alone have eliminated Olaf Ullmann as a suspect. Now, there's another mineral that we focused our attention on. This was biotite, which is a sheet silicate that has an iron phase in it. There's actually four mica minerals in the runestone. And it's a very complex geology. We actually took a core sample out of the back of the stone, made thin sections, identified the mineralogy. That's how I know exactly what's in there. Before we can do any forensic work on concrete or any other rock, we need to know exactly what we're starting with before we can even begin to try to figure out anything after that. But these mica minerals were very important. We had muscovite, biotite, sericite, and chlorite. I picked the biotite because it has the iron phase and it weathers the fastest of all these others.
Okay.
You with me?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't want anyone to accuse me of cooking the experiment.
Okay.
Because they will.
They will, huh? Okay.
Of course they will. They challenge everything, and that's okay.
Sure, sure.
You know what? This work needs to stand up to scrutiny.
That's right, that's right.
But what we found was that on the original inscription, when you break this rock, it's going to fail. The fracture failure plane is always going to go through the weakest minerals. That's the biotites.
Okay.
And so when we fracture this rock, you're always going to have the biotites exposed along with these other micas. So when we took the core sample out of the back, when we broke it off and we looked at the bottom of the core in a scanning electron microscope, and we had to use an SEM because we had to magnify it because these minerals are so small, they're very hard to see optically.
What's an SEM?
Scanning electron microscope.
Oh, there we go. Thanks. Okay.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
And when we did that, the entire fractured surface was all micas, including biotite. This is what I expected. And every time you break that rock, you're always going to have micas exposed, just like it, the day whoever carved that inscription, the micas were exposed. Now, on the top of the core, this stone was a glacial erratic, and it was dropped off, presumably in the area of Kensington, somewhere around 15,000 years ago when the glacier dropped it off. The entire surface would have been scratched by the glacier and had micas exposed. But when I took the core, the glacial surface, all the micas were gone. I expected that, okay? That was no surprise.
Okay.
And on the fresh sample, we had nothing but micas. So the question is, how long did it take for those micas to go away? Okay? Now, I took a chip sample off of the split side because the stone was actually broken down to the final shape that it now is.
Okay.
So that entire surface, what I call the split side, was broken down and exposed fresh, and then they carved the inscription on it. So I didn't need to take a sample from the inscription. I could take it from anywhere off that surface to represent the weathering of the original inscription. Are you
okay,
with me on that?
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, sure.
Okay. So I took that chip sample, and I put it in the SEM, and I was really quite surprised at what I saw. All the micas were gone. Intuitively, I said to myself that day, I go, this damn thing's real. But I didn't have enough evidence to prove that yet. So the question is, how long did it take for those micas from the original inscription to weather away?
Yeah, exactly.
That's the question,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right, yep.
This is how we answered it. I found a cemetery that had tombstones that had the right geology, slate, almost 99% biotite. It had the right mineral. It had the right climate, rainfall, mean annual high and an average mean annual low, very close to Kensington. Most important, I had to have the right grain size, and I found that. So I collected those samples with permission. And since the tombstones have the dates right on the stone, I just took samples going back in time until I saw when the biotite minerals began to come off the surface of those inscribed surfaces of the tombstone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a combination of a mechanical and a chemical weathering process. The actual minerals don't decompose to clays. They mechanically come off the surface before they decompose all the way.
Okay.
Which was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But the average number of years before that process started to happen was 194 years plus or minus 5.
Okay.
So I rounded it to about 200 years. That's when they begin to come off the surface. On the runestone inscription, they're all gone.
Mm-hmm.
So my conclusion is that the weathering of the inscription is older than 200 years from 1898, because remember, it hasn't been in a weathering environment since, right?
Yeah.
So that pushes it back from 1898. Well, I don't know anybody who's lived 200 years.
Mm. No, not yet, at least.
But you also have to understand something else that's very important. The first settlers came into that area of Minnesota beginning in 1860.
Mm-hmm.
So really, all you have to do is push the weathering back 40 years, and you don't have any realistic, logical candidates. We know the Native Americans didn't do it. They didn't have steel tools. So who did?
Yeah.
So to me, it's very simple. And what it does now is it boils down to a logic problem, in my opinion.
Mm.
Okay? And the logic is very simple. Remember, everything I do is logic.
Mm.
They're all logic problems. And the logic is this. The stone is either a modern hoax, as everybody claimed, or it's not.
That's right.
What other options do you have?
That's right. No, you don't have any other.
Right. So if the weathering says it's older than 200 years from 1898, a modern hoax, a late 19th century hoax, is impossible. It's impossible. So what have you got? Must be genuine.
You got the real thing. Yeah.
The only piece of data that we have is the date on the stone.
Mm.
So if it's genuine and that date is correct, then that means, based on logic, that everything in that inscription must be correct. It must be medieval because the geology says so.
Mm.
It also means that there has to be a plausible explanation, both in Scandinavia and in North America, to explain how that stone got here.
Mm-hmm.
Because it didn't fly over here and it didn't walk over here. Somebody came here and carved it.
Mm.
Now, one of the other things that we did geologically is we were able to identify what formation that rock came from.
Mm.
It's indigenous to Minnesota. It came from up by the Iron Range. It's part of something we call the Anamiki-Graywacke series.
Mm-hmm.
And the glaciers picked up that rock and placed it down into southern Minnesota, and it follows those glacial flow lines very nicely.
Mm.
And if this thing is genuine, everything has to fit together, right?
Yeah.
There can't be any problems. Well, thanks to Dick's work, he's found everything.
And
everything in that inscription works.
Yes, exactly. So what you're saying is that after looking at all the forensic work on the geology of the stone itself, and concluding that this pushes it back at least then to the 1600s, something like that, right?
Yes.
And because of that, you concluded that, okay, so the next logic step here is to look at the writing itself to see what actually is on there. Okay, yeah.
Correct. And I also looked into Mr. Oman as well, because in my mind, he found the stone. If there was a hoax going on, I'm sorry, he's involved.
Mm.
Okay? That's my opinion. I've always thought that.
Mm.
Well, Mr. Oman, when we delved into his history, he came through very well. But you have to understand something else about him. For the 37 years that he lived after he found the stone, he said, I didn't do it.
Hmm.
And in spite of what people say, they claim he was a practical joker. Trust me, you read those letters, you talk to his relatives, you look at his book collection, you look at his writing. This guy was no practical joker. Mm. He was anything but that. He was a very serious man. So this practical joke stuff is nonsense.
Mm.
And so because he said he didn't do it, that also boils down to one of two possibilities. He's either a liar, and it's a modern hoax, or he was telling the truth,
mm-hmm.
and it's genuine.
Yep.
I never hear people talk like this. I think I understand why that is, Henrik, and that kind of gets to some other issues, but the way that the problem was approached for 100 years was not logical. It wasn't scientific.
Mm-hmm.
I could give you examples for the next 10 days if you want. and my point isn't to try to go after people that didn't do a very good job in the past. I want to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
And my hope is, and my challenge to the scholars in Scandinavian America is, you know, Dick's a bright guy, and, you know, I'm a pretty smart guy too, but I'm no genius, I guarantee you.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that we found has to be duplicated by somebody else if they want to find it.
Mm-hmm.
It's out there.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is they've all become comfortable with what they think this thing is.
Sure.
And so they don't want to do anything.
Sure.
Come on, people, let's go.
And again, this is something that doesn't fit into the normal picture of what we, you know, how history has been laid out for us. So it's much more convenient to tuck this thing away or explain it away as a hoax than actually trying to look at the evidence here.
Well, you make a very good point. And the word I like to use is the word paradigm.
Mm.
There's a paradigm that's been established in certain disciplines that there was nobody here before Columbus.
Right.
And what I've personally seen myself, is that when something does come up that suggests that maybe that paradigm isn't correct, it's dismissed, it's marginalized, or ignored.
Mm-hmm.
And coming from, you know, a technical background, I don't understand that at all. I mean, that to me is just crazy.
Well, it's not science, you know, in that sense.
No, it's not.
You know, and yet science is supposed to provide us with the answer to just these kinds of questions, you know. So.
Well, you know, and the other thing that I think is interesting here is that, you know, this research is not easy. It's expensive. It takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
It's very difficult. So, you know, and remember, you're for a lot of people that are in various disciplines, this is something that they've been told is decided.
Yeah.
And so why would they go to all this extra energy and expense when they've already been told what the answer is?
Mm.
I can appreciate that. But you know what? Just because you're told something doesn't always mean it's right.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, I mean, who has been, just to kind of sneak that in here, are you paying for the research? Is there a group or an interest group behind this? How is this financed, you know?
Well, I was hired originally, and I'll just go back for a second to that day when they hired me.
Mm.
I gave them the speech I give all my customers. Because remember, I'm an independent. I said, look, I'll do this work for you, but you need to understand that I may come back and give you news that you're not going to like.
Mm.
But you're still going to pay me, because no matter what the results are, I get paid either way. And when I started this work, Henrik, I'll tell you right now, I didn't know what the Kensington Runestone was, and I didn't really care. I care today,
mm-hmm.
because I know what it is, and I know that it's important,
mm-hmm.
and I know it needs to be studied further.
Yeah.
But I sent out my last invoice to the Runestone Museum in December of 2000, and I've been working for free ever since.
Oh, really?
Now, I'm fortunate to be able to have a business where I have a wonderful staff that does a terrific job, and it allows me to take the time I need to pursue this.
Mm.
But I feel it's important, and I think that for whatever reason, I find myself in this position where I have some impact on this particular discussion. And, you know, I like a controversy.
Mm.
I mean, I'm very competitive, but the one thing that I do not ever mess around with, I like to have a good time personally. You know, I'm very free with my opinion, and I'll tell you exactly what I think.
Mm.
But when it comes to my professional opinion, I don't ever screw around.
Mm.
And I will never say anything unless I feel I have the evidence and the support to back up my statement. That is very, very important.
Yeah.
And when people like you in the media are talking to people that don't think this is genuine, when you ask them that question, make sure you ask the follow-up question. Why?
Mm.
Give me the reasons why you don't think this is real.
Yeah.
Because I tell you what, saying that these words are modern, or that the grammar's not right, or that the runes are wrong, that's not, they can't support that.
Mm.
That is not correct.
Mm.
The record is different. And when they sit back and they scoff and they say, oh, these guys don't know what they're talking about, really, look it up. Because here's a simple explanation to why the experts in the past did not find what we've been able to find.
Mm-hmm.
The reason is it didn't exist until now. For whatever reason, the treasure trove of medieval runic inscriptions that exist on the island of Gotland, which was part of Sweden then and is still part of Sweden now,
yep,
had not been studied until recently.
Mm.
In fact, they are still studying those runic inscriptions of Gotland. There are hundreds of them.
Yeah.
And I've been to Gotland twice. And I've been to all 92 churches where many of these inscriptions are carved into grave slabs that are mortared into the floors of those churches. I've been to every one of them. And they're still publishing those runic inscriptions on the internet. I mean, they're not done yet.
That's right. Yeah, this is a work in progress. You're right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so Dick and I are the first ones to look at these runic inscriptions in context with the Kensington Runestone ever.
Mm.
That's where we found everything, and everybody else that goes to look, they'll find it too.
Yeah, and make the connection, of course, between these, because, I mean, tell us about that. How did you end up, you know, going to Gotland for, you know, for confirming what is on the stone? How did this connection happen, so to speak?
Well, Dick deserves credit for this, Dick Nielsen. And he also was given some help from Professor Henrik Williams at the university. And I apologize if I butcher this name. I think it's Uppsala. I want to say Uppsala University. And but Henrik is one of the top runologists, and he's a terrific guy, extremely intelligent, and he's a nice guy too. I happen to like him a lot personally. But
the word. Help. The word you're looking for is Uppsala, so you're very close to it, by the way.
Okay, well, pardon me if I butcher these names.
No problem.
I don't intend to. Anyway.
Sounds good, yeah.
Okay, well, I'm getting better. Anyway, Dick spent all kinds, I mean, he spent years looking at these various inscriptions that were published. There are three volumes of the Gotlandic Runinscriptor that has been published, and he found these, you know, these features,
mm-hmm.
the grammar, the runes, the dialect, and the dating. And so many of these things were unclear to us. Some of the inscriptions are weathered, and so we decided that we had to go and look at them ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing that I always do. I don't trust other people's research. I found too many mistakes, too much bias, too much... You got to go check it out yourself.
Yeah.
And that's what we did. And I'll tell you what, we found some examples of a very important rare rune called the dotted R. We found three of them that the scholars missed. And Henrik, to my knowledge, said, hey, that was good work, guys. We got to go back and take another look at these.
Yeah.
Another scholar that he's worked with is out of the University College in London, Professor Michael Barnes. And these people, they've given Dick a lot of credit for the work that he did. You know, I know enough, as I said before, to be extremely dangerous. I'm certainly not an expert, but I've certainly made an effort to try to learn as much as I can. I understand the runes pretty well,
mm-hmm.
how language evolves over time. And the other thing you have to consider is that there's a very unique record in Gotland, because language evolves just like biology evolves differently when it's sequestered on an island like that.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah.
You know, so it's really not beyond, you know, logic to say, hey, there is something unique about Gotland, partly because it's an island and it was isolated. So things evolve differently. Language certainly evolves over time. And I think this is one of the reasons why we have these unique anomalies that nobody was aware of before.
Mm, yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, I mean, Gotland to this day, even they have you can even, the dialect, actually, if you compare it to, you know, the more other Swedish, the dialect that they use on Gotland is very different. So, yeah, I mean, just there, there's tremendous difference. So, yeah, you're right.
So, you know, and I hope that, you know, if there are some scholars listening, you know, I get kind of fired up sometimes, and I'll be honest with you, we had some people that were very challenging with us there. I don't think they took this as serious as they could have. So, you know, I've got a few bruises that are still healing, but, you know, going after people, especially people in the past, isn't going to get us anywhere.
No.
Because we have a whole new data set that they never had an opportunity to consider, so that's not their fault.
That's right.
And we need to move forward because this is really important. And I'll tell you what, it's fun.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Scott. I totally agree. And that's what we're trying to do here also, bring this attention to the surface so people are aware of it and more people can study it also, of course, that because a lot of this stuff isn't brought up in the mainstream, and when it does, it's some angle to it or whatever. But one thing I do want to get into is this kind of the scripts itself, because we refer to it. We went through kind of the data that you have been involved in and so forth. But the question then is, what is on the stone itself? What does it say? You know.
Well, I tell you what, I'll be happy to tell you. And what I'll do is I will give you the translation, and this is based primarily on Dick's work, but there's some very significant changes. And one of the things that's very, very important that we discovered on Gotland, or Dick discovered on Gotland, and I verified when I went there, was that there's something called the Thorn Ruin, which looks like a capital D as a dog that has the vertical axis, the main stave, extended on the top and bottom. That's called the Thorn Ruin. And what we discovered on Gotland in medieval times is that in the front part of a word, they call it the initial position. All the scholars thought that it stood for the D sound. And in the mainland, from Viking times through medieval times, it did stand for D. But on Gotland in medieval times, it never stood for D. It stood for T. That's a very important fundamental difference. And I'll tell you in just a sec why that is. But that's important. That's one of the unique features about Gotland. Now, in the final position, in the latter part of a word, the Thorn Ruin stands for the eth sound, like breath, TH. So that's consistent. But here's where it becomes important. On the stone, it says, starting on the face side in the upper left corner, 8 gutter and 22 Northmen or Norwegians on this. And then the longest word in the inscription was long thought to be journey of discovery. That's because the Thorn Ruin in the initial position makes that Abdog Elsafar, then I know I didn't pronounce that right, but it would be journey of discovery if that Thorn Ruin was a D, which everybody thought it was. But that's not what it is. It stands for T, which makes it Abtaga Elsafar, journey of acquisition or taking up land. That's a very, very, very important difference, and it changes the context of the message dramatically. So it says 8 Goths and 22 Norwegians on this acquisition business, Vinland far to the west. We had camped by 2, and the word here we think means shelters, skiar. We're not sure what that word is, but it's a point of reference. We had camped by 2 skerries, shelters maybe, 1 day's journey north from the stone. On line 6 it says, we were fishing one day. And, you know, this line always bothered me for a long time. Why would they talk about fishing. I mean, fishing to sustain themselves seemed rather trite and unimportant to me. But now we know that this is a Christian document. And just so everybody understands, I get so tired of hearing people say, oh, the Vikings came to Minnesota. This is medieval times, not Viking times. So let's get off that whole Viking discussion. This is not a Viking document. This is a Christian document. We can talk more about that later. But with that context, we were fishing to me, this is my own opinion, is that it's probably fisher of men, fishing
Christ.
For souls.
Yeah.
Preaching.
Yeah.
Okay? If this is a priest, maybe he's documenting that he's doing what he was supposed to be doing. I don't know. That's my interpretation. I could be wrong. But it makes it fits better for me.
Well, you're right. I believe you're right on there, actually. Yeah. Interesting,
okay.
Yeah.
We were fishing one day. After we came home, found 10 men red from blood and death. The word is death, T-E-T-H. It's thorny thorn. Everybody thought the word was dead. But again, when you look at the Gotlandic thorn ruin, the word is death. Now, does that change the context? I don't know, but that's the correct word. And then immediately after that, you have three Latin letters, A-V-M. Many people believe it's for the Ave Maria prayer.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Probably is. And then the last line on the front is, save from evil. On the split side, we have the word hair.
Yeah.
There are 10 men by the sea to look after our ships. 14 days journey from this island, year 1362.
Wow.
Very interesting.
Very interesting indeed.
Yes.
So this,
now,
yeah.
There's more in the inscription that we found. And just so you understand, after I did my initial geologic work, I knew the stone was genuine, and I said somebody has to do a detailed study and document exactly what's on this stone, because some of the things that I read clearly indicated to me that nobody had looked very carefully at it and they had some of the runes wrong. So I did that on my own, and I spent 24 hours taking photographs under the microscope using low-angle and high-angle reflected light. So you could see pull out the three-dimensionality of the characters, so you could see exactly how each character was carved. As I was doing this, I found things in the inscription, like punch marks within the lines and extra little strokes off of some of the runes. Nobody had ever seen these things before. You know why?
No.
Because they didn't look carefully. They never bothered to look because it's a fake. Why would you spend time on a fake, right?
Yeah, I see what you mean. Okay.
So I started finding these things, and I photographed them, and I remember sending these to Dick. I go, Dick, what's this? He goes, I don't know what it is. Well, for 4 years, and there's a lot of these anomalies in the stone. For 4 years, we didn't know what they meant. We think we do know what they are now. And they're simple codes, and they're very simple. One of them is a simple prayer. And I think it's a prayer for the 10 dead men. And I think what the carver did is after he carved the inscription, what I call the business part of the inscription, afterwards, he carved a simple prayer using the word grail.
Oh, really?
If you pull out the first four runes that are singled out by the carver, it's G-R-A-L. In medieval Old Swedish, that's grail.
That's right.
That grail. Now, this is fantastic, right?
Yeah.
Well, not really. You know why?
No.
Because on Gotland, every one of those churches had a Cistercian priest. The Cistercians wrote the grail legends back at that time. So what's the big deal? It's not a big deal. It's consistent, just like everything else is consistent. Everybody's going to go, oh, it's the Da Vinci Code. This is the Da Vinci Code. This is the Cistercians, and this is what they would do. But I think what he did is after he talked about the death of the 10 men, he just used a punch code and put a prayer in there for the 10 dead men.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what a priest would probably do?
That's right. That's right. Exactly. The customs of where they came from, and they're continuing that. And if this was as you say, a Cistercian priest. Do you know if the Goths or the Gutar, as you're referring to?
Yeah.
Do you know if these guys were perhaps then the Cistercian priests, or were there some other guys involved here? I mean, 22 Norwegians and 8 Goths.
Answer to that question is I don't know who they were.
But
I can speculate. I don't know who they were. I feel pretty confident in my opinion of who they were. I think we had at least one, possibly two Cistercian priests, part of the 8 Goths, or how did you pronounce it again?
Gutar.
Oh, yeah. I love that. I think we had one or possibly two Cistercian priests. I think the 6 or 7 other Güter were either Knights Templar or Teutonic Knights. And this would make perfect sense as well, because the Cistercians essentially created the Knights Templar.
Yeah.
In 1128, St. Bernard of Clairvaux wrote their charter and pleaded successfully to the Pope that they needed a military order to fight the Crusades, protect pilgrims. And there was more to what they did, but they were essentially Cistercians with swords. A lot of people have criticized us by mentioning the Templars, and I just say, well, why? You obviously don't know your history very well if you're going to criticize that, because I would expect them to travel together.
That's right. And Scott, I mean, this opens up, of course, a whole new avenue. I mean, and so much more the consequence of this. And again, the rewriting of history. There's so much, you know, more to talk about here. And I do want to continue talking to you, but I think that this is a great time to take a little break, you know, and continue with part two. But before we finish off, I want to leave a few minutes to you so you can mention the current book that you have out, your website, and also, of course, your upcoming book that you're working on.
Oh, well, that's great. I appreciate that. Well, as you had mentioned before, the book we have out right now, which I think is really good. Yes, I'm biased, but I do think it's a great book, and Dick really did a terrific job as well. It's called The Kensington Runestone, Compelling New Evidence. It's 574 pages. And for those scholars that are interested out there, there's a lot of good stuff in here, and I think you'll think it's quite good. You can take a look at it on our website, which, as you mentioned, is www.kensingtonrunestone.com, all one word. And it retails for $29.95, and I think for what you get, that's a great value. We didn't publish this book to make money. Basically, we break even, but as I said before, I have a job, so I'm doing okay, but, you know, that's we felt this was important. That's why we did it the way we did. But I do have a new book, and this book is a 2005 publication. It came out in December of 2005, so it's not quite 2 years old, but I have a new manuscript that I just finished the last chapter last night, as a matter of fact, but I have some more work to do, but it'll be a smaller volume, but the title of the book is called The Hooked X, Key to the Secret History of North America. And I suspect that will be out probably within the next 6 months, but it picks up where, you know, the Runestone book takes off or leaves off. And admittedly, a lot of what we have is speculation based upon very sound historical facts, but we've also discovered a lot of really good new solid evidence that's consistent not only with the runestone, the Kensington stone being a medieval artifact, but there are 4 more runestones that are clearly connected to the KRS, specifically with this Hooked X character that's confused scholars, stumped them for over 100 years. I think we figured out what it is, but it's the key to this whole thing. And there are 4 more runestones in North America that were found on the East Coast. Most people are not aware of them. And there's probably a lot of other evidence that would be consistent with these people that we think we're talking about in North America, but they need to be studied. Currently, they are unknowns, and they need to be studied. But it's a fantastic story, and you know, historians are probably scratching their heads right now wondering, well, what's going on here? Well, the simple reason why this has been such a mystery is because these people came over here secretly. It was very quiet. And the main reason for that is because we believe they were under severe religious persecution. So they had to keep it quiet. And that's why there's very little record. But there is a record out there, and if we look, I'm confident we'll find more.
Wow, that's incredible, and I do want to continue speaking about that in the next segment. But for this segment, thank you so much for coming on, Scott.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Scott and I will continue talking in the subscriber section about the Cistercians and the Templar Purge. Why did the Cistercians flee to America? Are there any traces of them still left? Did they assimilate into some of the Native American tribes? And does this in any way connect with the genocide of the Native Americans? Scott and I also go off on a very different tangent and talk about some of his findings when he did forensic work on the Pentagon after 9/11. How did the damage caused by fire affect the steel-reinforced concrete? Scott looked at this and tells us that there were some major differences here compared to other structural damage caused by fire. Very interesting material coming up in the subscriber section. If you're currently not subscribing and want to tune in to the continuation of this interview and get full access to our radio archive going back to over a year, just click on subscribe on redicecreations.com and follow the simple steps to sign up. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren behind the controls. This is Henrik Palmgren. Take good care. We'll talk more soon.